Welcome back to the Content That Grows podcast. I'm your host, Nate Turner. Today, we're going to be talking about how to establish an editorial process that gets consistent results. I'm joined today by Ryan Sargent, VP of Content and Strategy at 10Speed. How's it going, Ryan?
Good. Glad to be back.
Yeah, excited to dig in on this. There's a lot to uncover. I think a lot of people focus on the content creation side of things when they discuss how it's done and typical process and tips and tricks and all these different things. And maybe not as much on what about after that piece is written. And then specifically what we're talking about today is I think a lot of in-house teams and folks can pretty easily look at a topic, decide they want to write about it, create it to their level of quality. And we'll kind of get into what quality means in a moment as well. And publish it, but doing one-offs versus consistently being able to produce, and scale up over time, requires some of these different processes and systems and stuff. And so what we want to get into is just, helping realize that scale does not have to be the enemy of quality, or that it's going to take you, away from where you need to be. So that's what we're diving into today. So I think, quality is so subjective and gets a visceral reaction from a lot of people. And so, I think, from this standpoint, we want to just kind of define what we mean, if we say quality throughout the episode, just to kind of be clear about what that is.
Yeah. And you and I were talking literally right before you hit record, right? That there's this huge piece of content process, and zeroing in on specifically this kind of editorial phase is something that I think more content folks want to spend time on. It's like producing videos, right? We all know we should do it, and then we don't actually ever execute right on it in the right way. Because I think if you asked content folks, they would absolutely say, oh yeah, no, the piece isn't done when I get the first draft. There's so much more that goes into it. And then the wheels kind of come off. And that's why we're zeroing in on this phase.
Yeah.
If you want a hot take about quality, I'll direct you to LinkedIn, where you can find them with an easy search. Because we're talking about this specific phase of kind of the content process at large, so much of editorial for me is making sure that the content meets the minimum bar. There is a threshold below which it's not even content yet. This covers everything from spelling errors to, did you use the right camel case for your product, or is product marketing going to be mad at you? All of that stuff. If you don't clear that bar, it's just not even a piece yet. You can't say that you're building content. So that is the primary goal of editorial. And where that overlaps with some of these larger, more conceptual discussions of quality for me is, I don't think you've met that bar until you also include some of these more qualitative measures. It's not as simple as, did we follow the style guide? Did we run Grammarly? The editorial process has to include a measure of quality that looks at things like product positioning, unique point of view. Did we actually include our company's ethos in here somewhere? Did we build a piece of content that's relevant and useful for our target audience? Did we build it for the right target audience, right? Yeah. Asking those kinds of questions also form for me the minimum bar. And so that's kind of still a broad definition of quality, but we're talking about, for purposes of this discussion, how does the editorial process, the everything that happens between draft and publish, go towards that larger quality goal?
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I think you hit on that well. And so I think, from there, the conversation then is about what is that in-house? So you mentioned camel case for product marketing sake and all that. And so really just, over the years, I think I've seen just about every iteration of, we have in-house writers, we have outsourced writers, we have agencies, we have in-house editors, we have outsourced editors, we have an agency that edits, and there's all kinds of different ways teams are, completing the steps. But where there can be the snags and stuff is when you aren't flagging things ahead of time. All of a sudden, before hitting publish, someone wants product marketing review. Someone looks at a piece from a totally different perspective and says, why did we do this? There are a lot of those things that I think over time kind of start to just slow things down And so, you know, it's very much, it's not just about a checklist, I guess is what I'm trying to say. There's stakeholders, there's perspectives, there's all these things you kind of have to figure out ahead of time. So I think, you know, getting there into that best step is really kind of thinking about month in and month out. How do you keep building what you need to build to accomplish your goals, knowing that you're still hitting on all the things you need to?
That's the challenge, right? Is how do you document and create a process that accommodates and accounts for most of it while also being flexible enough to account for differences, especially on an in-house team, right? Where not every piece is the same, where you're likely building or responsible for in some way organic strategy and that like traditional content role. You're also building sales enablement. You're also helping product marketing. You're also handling one-off random brand requests because HR needs a new hoodie logo. Like all of those things go into an in-house content team and or creative team. And if you have a rigid process for every single one of those, you're going to be underwater instantly.
Yeah.
You need, at the same time, if you submit one of those things that doesn't meet that minimum quality bar, you're also underwater in a very different way. So having a bend don't break process, I think, is big. Tactically, that often looks like an intake form that maybe has branching logic. I don't want to spend too much time on that tactical stuff, but there are ways to get that all that brand guidelines, brand compliance stuff going, while at the same time letting you spend your effort on the thing that in-house content teams are good at, like building the content that drives the business result. Like as important as the hoodie is, like ultimately you're on the marketing team. Yeah. Like that's what you're. I think the degree of difficulty only goes up as you're trying to scale and build something consistent month to month. That's where enforcing those guidelines comes down to involving the right stakeholders at the right times.
Yeah.
And that's I think the big takeaway for this piece of process is figure out when certain people need to be involved and set the expectation. These are the people at this time. This isn't random. We're not figuring this out as we go along. And the relationships you build with the product team, with the sales team, with the CS team, this is when you cash in. Every time you do them a favor, you're saving it so that you can enforce your policy and your process.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, we've talked a bit in the podcast, and I've done at least one webinar on like even just getting as specific as content decay and how you like stay on top of that over time. That's a huge systems and processes thing. And a big part of that is like, it doesn't start at like addressing decay. It starts at like your planning and like making sure your monthly, quarterly planning has space for it and people understand it. And so I think similarly in what you're saying is like identifying who those stakeholders are, when they're going to be used. And then as a team, also just understanding we can't be, you know, on the 1 yard line about to publish this and go, oh, hey, ping this stakeholder and ask them for review. Oh, whoops, they're on vacation or they're busy or whatever. It's like, no, this was planned for in the, you know, roadmap planning for the month or the quarter or whatever. And they're aware it's on their queue. Like they know it's coming. And we've built in lead times for them to be able to review it. All of those things that I think are necessary to make sure that you're getting the people involved that need to be, but it's not, you know, slowing down or holding up your publishing.
Inevitably, there are going to be wrinkles too. I don't know anyone who has set up a process like this that has had it run flawlessly. Right. And I think there's a lot of room here to account for specifics to your industry or business as well. Like, this email whole series has to be HIPAA compliant. Well, yeah, we're going to add a whole legal review layer to this, right? Like it's not. So there's room that's, I think, a good example of like the flexibility I'm talking about. The flexibility isn't, are we going to use a different style guide? It's, oh, legal also needs to review this, and we have that accounted for in the roadmap.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's great. So speaking of that, I think it's worth maybe talking about like rounds of editing. You mentioned before about like sort of that like table stakes of just grammar and some of those basic things. So, you know, obviously that's an aspect of editing. Tone and voice is an aspect of editing. Product positioning, the product marketing perspective, and brand, like, you know, it's maybe worth covering, like, is that one round with a huge checklist? Is that multiple rounds? Is it different people? I think that's probably a big variable for a lot of people and how that's accomplished and done consistently. So I think we should get into that too.
Yeah. So in part of the, this often goes off the rails when we don't account for resources. Like, I think part of a content leader's job in this environment, in this editorial phase, is to conserve resources without dropping the quality bar. And that's, I think that starts for me philosophically by putting conceptual edits before line edits. Like, that's my, it's like one of the Ten Commandments for me of, in terms of like this process. So I don't want to spend any time, effort, energy on line edits until we're very confident that the thing is meeting its goals, that the piece is accomplishing what we want it to accomplish, that it's not a bottom of funnel piece with a bunch of top of funnel filler, that it's actually providing sales with a resource they're going to use and isn't going to rot in a folder. That is a tough thing to talk to stakeholders about, because every stakeholder that sees a draft is going to just nitpick the crap out of the grammar. And it's like, no, I understand that that sentence is in passive voice. We will fix that. But we have to get the goal of the piece right. For 10 speed, that looks like having the person who wrote the brief edit the piece before it actually gets to line edits. And I would encourage in-house teams to use a similar process. Who was in charge of building the brief? Who went and found the SME quotes? Who did that interview with your head of sales? Yeah. That person needs to review, whether they wrote the draft or not, that person needs to review the draft as a step one of editorial to make sure that it's meeting those goals. Then we can do a round of line edits. And for big, giant in-house pieces, there's probably multiple rounds of this stuff. For a simple blog post, and obviously for you get it down to one round, but start with that kind of very conceptual quality check first. And then you get to cook through the line edits. They move faster because the person who's doing the line edits, which I think should be a person, not AI, for what it's worth. We have humans edit AI content because we know it's not good enough. Why would we have an AI edit human content? That's just asking for trouble. The person doing those line edits then gets to edit with the confidence that the piece is doing the right things. Yeah. And they now get to truly serve as a backup, not a first line of defense on things like product positioning. They're going to catch stuff. And that's why there's multiple layers and multiple rounds. For something like a blog post, it may be that you only need those two rounds. Someone checks to make sure that the piece is going to accomplish its goals, meet search intent, talk to the right ICP. And then it goes through a line edit and you're done. Get it in WordPress. It scales up from there, obviously. And that's part of that flexibility that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and that's, I think one of my favorite parts of our editorial process for clients is having that person who did the research, understands the goal of the piece, all of that, really being that first line to say, did this even accomplish that or not? Like, because otherwise you're just spending too much time on things that are probably gonna have to change and be line edited again. And so, yeah, I think that one's core. I'm glad you called out the AI editing. You know, I think that certainly, I do, you know, like everything, I feel like there's never anything I've come across AI wise where I just draw, you know, a line in the sand and say, this is absolutely unacceptable in every case. I think there's probably some cases where AI editing makes sense in the business world, certain things, sure. But in this case where you're talking about wanting things to be on brand, and you want it to reflect your product positioning, and it's you've taken the time, like, why take the time to get SME input and, you know, any of that other research if you're just going to let an AI edit it that doesn't understand all the nuance within that? Like, I think there's a lot there. So, so for us, I guess you want to just quickly hit on what all three of the editing rounds are for us, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, so we do the two rounds I just mentioned, the round where the person who built the brief who interviewed an SME, whether async or on a call, does that initial check. I believe the last I checked, the Asana task for that step in our process has 17 sub-bullets. Mm. We're doing everything from a fact check to, is this statistic actually found in the source that we cited?
Yep.
To, did we name the product correctly? Is there a miscapitalization in the name of the company? So all of that product positioning stuff happens at that layer. Then we send it to line edits. Obviously we're working at such a scale that work doesn't always happen in house. But to account for that, we do a third round where our editorial lead looks at every word we send and provides the last line of defense. And I want to point out that it's 3+ because at that point, my role is not any of those three pieces. So there's, even after a last line of defense with our editorial lead, there's still me if something were to happen, as an emergency pull the cord. And we also do a round of revisions.
Yeah.
So if something were to not be exactly right, or we decided we want to pivot or change at the last minute, there's the flexibility to account for it with changes to the piece after we deliver it to a client.
And I think a lot of what you're saying also makes it worth bringing up. Like, so for us, we create what we call just like single source of truth for every client, which is really all of the data they've given us, stuff we've gotten from intake forms, stuff we get from context, from conversations over time, all kind of makes its way into that single source of truth. And that is a big part of what allows consistency as well across, you know, if we have contract editors and just each of the rounds, making sure that the writer, the brief builder, the writer, editor, and like any final edits are all kind of referencing the same truth about positioning and all that stuff. So I think that's probably worth calling out as well, regardless if it's how you're doing it in-house or what your steps are. I think that, you know, in-house, you probably have a tendency to go, oh, everyone knows because they're in-house and, you know, they work here and they get it, but like not necessarily true. And then if you start introducing any freelancer, you just have a freelance writer for your in-house team, then you start to have some wider variables there. So I think that's probably worth, if there's anything else you want to add, just the impact of having something like that, you know, across multiple steps.
Yeah. I mean, like most brand marketers, I've had the horrifying realization that the top sales rep has an email signature that is just making a mockery of the brand book. Like that happens. And because it's the top sales rep, you can't really do anything about it. Like, That was a bad day. Yeah. I remember that. And the single source of truth goes so far in combating that. Like, it provides this one place, whether that's an Airtable, a Google Doc, it's this place where everybody knows they can go and they will get a consistent answer. And it's a living document. It's something that keeps being updated and revised and improved in our case at an agency as we get feedback from clients. So every time a client makes a comment in a doc, every time a client sends something back for a revision, every time we have a conversation about, hey, this intro didn't seem to line up with our brand values, right? Like, all of that stuff makes its way into the single source of truth, on top of things like every time we mention this product feature, we capitalize the word code, right? Like, all of that lines up exactly with the single source of truth. So it's also worth noting there's some things in that kind of three-step process that don't necessarily line up. And voice and tone is one of them. We don't do a separate pass for voice and tone, in part because it lives in the single source of truth. It's something that writers have access to. It's something that when we do line edits, we include it in that process. Also because I don't think voice and tone makes or breaks your top of funnel blog post.
Yeah.
It is the icing on the cake. It is more important on other types of content. Voice and tone matter much more for content you're using to drive authority than it does for something that you're using to generate traffic. And so pick your battles there. Don't die on the voice and tone hill.
I agree. I think there's a lot there. I know I've referenced it at least once before. Jacob, head of content at ActiveCampaign, had a similar comment of like, you know, it's just more important to get it out and get it done and good. And I also, if you just think objectively, like, yes, you know, like you want your company to care and you have, you know, voice and tone guides for a reason. And there's all these things, but there's also the reality that like so much of your content in your program is just designed to like help give people good information and solve their pain points and solve their problems. And people are going to remember if you solved their problem a lot more than, you know, any sort of active passive voice or, you know, any of that kind of stuff that, that may kind of be in that tone and voice guide that, it's really, you know, you want to just be impactful and help them as much as possible.
The nice thing is that this is an easy conversation to have as you head up the food chain for an in-house content marketer, that voice and tone isn't what drives the business result necessarily. So if the point of having an organic, you know, content program is to drive the business result, then we're about putting the effort behind the parts of this program that are going to do the best for the business. And that is a message that usually resonates upstairs. So if that's where I would start, if you're struggling to have the conversation with someone, I don't know, a head of creative, et cetera, that is like, why are we not spending more time and energy here? And it's because that's not what's going to drive the result with your content program.
Yep. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the compromise that I've experienced personally and also seen elsewhere is, I think there's a pretty easy way to have a short list of non-negotiables.
That's a really good way to put it.
Be open-handed about some of the others. So I, cause it's totally fine. There should be some things that are non-negotiables and kind of what you said before of like, it's not even content yet if it doesn't have some of those things. And I think that's important, but really kind of how we got past. We had, you know, some challenges with this exact thing very early on at Sprout. And it was sort of like this idea of quality and we needed more people reviewing and finally got to a point of saying, what are the non-negotiables? What are the things we have to hit? As long as we're hitting these, you don't have to look at it. And then like, you know, some other criteria that really just started to speed it up. And so I think there's a lot there, but one other thing I want to make sure you don't miss, is maybe you just speak to like some of your thoughts on lead times, and just making sure those are kind of baked into the process overall, because I mentioned it earlier just sort of in passing. And I think it's actually one of the important aspects of all of it to not get derailed is just giving people the time and space they need. So I think we should maybe just hit on that a little bit.
Yeah. My last addition on the like non-negotiables piece would be that often the parts of voice and tone that are non-negotiable are also the things that are non-negotiable in terms of making the content relevant and helpful for a reader. There's almost a one-to-one overlap there in my experience. In terms of lead times, this is a place where I think people have a lot of flexibility. There's not a one size fits all answer because people are building different kinds of content.
Yeah.
They're building content in different industries, in different environments, at different company stages and sizes. So a lot of that for me comes back to the strategy. If you're dedicating a quarter to sales enablement long form, you're going to need more lead time. That's a much more difficult task than dedicating a sprint or a quarter to top of funnel blog post design to make sure that you're now in the top 10 positions for as many keywords as possible. So tailoring that a bit to the work you're doing, I think is important. The thing I didn't say there is that means that you're working ahead on the strategy, that you have the next 3 months planned out. So the lead time in that case ultimately kind of was baked into the strategy as much as it was baked into the editorial process. For a more concrete tactical answer on the editorial side, a lot of that depends on how well you've documented that single source of truth and your non-negotiables. Yeah. And if that stuff is well documented, you can turn stuff around very quickly. We often dedicate a day to each of these editing stages, and that's all it takes.
Yeah.
And can turn things around for clients pretty quickly as a result. So we have a well-oiled machine in that respect. Everybody knows their role. Everything is documented. And we're used to doing this at scale month in and month out. So I think what on paper might look pretty daunting in terms of the amount of content that we review and how many times we review it is ultimately the product of a lot of lead time. Yeah. over the last months and years. So I kind of danced around that. Do you want me to actually just like put a number on it?
No, I don't think it needs a number, but I would just add, I think, we talked earlier about you need to know who's involved and at what steps. And I think, probably don't have to go so far as having a formal SLA with each of those people, but just have a real open conversation about like, when we task you with this, how much time do you want for each one? And they might say, I can do each in, 2 days or 3 days or whatever. And then like, I've been an account manager and an agency before doing web projects. And I know that whatever a developer tells you or designer tells you, you double it before you talk to the client. And so like, if someone says I could do each of them in 48 hours, like give yourself 72 and just understand each step and add them up and then say, okay, well now if I want to start planning for this to go live on whatever, June 1st or, some date, then I actually need to have this brief done by April 1st or, that's a huge lead time there, but whatever it is, like do the math, add it up, build in some cushion and just give yourself that leeway so that each person who needs to be involved isn't just being rushed or burnt out or, checking the box. And then you're like adding the step that adds no value. Just be realistic about what that takes. And I think that that's a huge part of being able to do it consistently every month is just start, far enough in advance. And the other thing I would say is if you have some combined output between blog posts and sales name and other stuff, sales enablement and other content of say 10 pieces a month, like publish, 6 to 8 for the first couple of months while you're working and kind of building a little bit of a backlog so that you also kind of, once things are rolling, then you can like maintain a pretty consistent publishing because you're kind of always working with a little bit of a buffer and, delivering on time and getting people things they need without, again, kind of blowing up your whole schedule because you're, just kind of like minute to minute trying to get everything done.
Yeah. And that's in line with a lot of kind of process best practice, right? That like people are going to get sick. People are going to go on PTO. People are going to have all those adjustments. And so to avoid having a single point of failure, you work ahead. And that's that's baked into our process here as well, that everything from our ability to bring things in-house, to have folks who've worked the account in the past cover and et cetera. So, someone going on vacation shouldn't sink your whole ship.
Totally. No, and I've also just been the impatient marketer with goals to hit and, wanting to, push. And so I guess my point there is like, don't see, additional rounds of review or approval or input or whatever as this is holding me up. You just have to plan accordingly to get ahead of it and have that buffer. And then you really can kind of keep moving at the pace you want to and getting the results you want. It's just you've accounted for the additional time ahead of time versus feeling it's holding you up. So yeah, lots of stuff there. And we didn't get into all kinds of nuance of the actual, very, very detailed editorial stuff. And there's all kinds of other parts of the content process, but just really felt like this is an area where it has the potential to kind of go sideways or have others in the organization feel like things aren't getting reviewed like they need to, or, you know, just all kinds of challenges that I think come up in-house. And then obviously, again, many in-house teams have some sort of augmentation with freelancers and agencies that can, you know, further compound this if it's not handled correctly. So, yeah, so I think it's an important topic. Anything else you wanted to hit on before we wrap it up?
It's an easy part of the process to autopilot. And that is like both very, very true and is often the source of pain. You can't put it on autopilot until you've built out the process. And that's where I think a lot of folks should be investing more time.
Yeah.
This is worth investing in the long term.
Yeah, totally agree. Awesome. All right. We'll go ahead and wrap it up there. This was a great episode. Feel free to check out other episodes we have at 10speed.io/podcast. And be sure to like and subscribe on your platform of choice. And I think we're all set there. So thanks a lot, Ryan, for your time. This was great.
Awesome. Always fun.